Jayama Sadhuno Pante Bhagavasuchira Parinibhutopi Pashima Janata Nukampamanasa Ime Sakale Dukatapanakarabhute Pakiganhatu Amhaka Dhitavata Hitaya Sukhaya Alahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavanta Abhivade Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamma Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammāsambuddhassa Namo Tassa Arahato Sammāsambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammāsambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahant Sammāsambuddho Vijacharana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anusaro Purissa Dhamma Sarakti Sata Deva Manusanang Buddho Bhagava Tamahan Bhagavanta Abhipujayami Tamahan Bhagavanta Silasanamam Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatam Veditapo Vinyuhi Tamaham Dhamma Abhipujayami Tamaham Dhamma Sirasanamam Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samicchipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yatidam Chattari Purissa Yugani Atta Purissa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anutaran Punya Kekang Lokasa Tamahan Sangam abhi pujayami tamaham sangha sirasanamam.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false use, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu.
Ho, ho, ho. The question, and the first question is, please use the microphone. So there is one question from the floor. It was on the floor. So please continue your explanation on right effort and the mistranslation of the word too. This will carry on tomorrow for the morning talk about the Eightfold Path and how it all fits together. Next question. I can hear clearly others breathing, but can recognize my breathing. How can I recognize my inside instead of outside? Thanks. It doesn't matter what you recognize or what you don't recognize, because inside, outside, all one needs to really do is just the one most prominent, sensation. Just let the mind choose. You don't need to recognize it, whether it's your breathing or other people's breathing, it's just breathing. So in other words, just whatever's the most prominent object, whatever's right in front of you, that's the most important. Emperor's three questions. And that means that you don't need to recognize anything except just this moment. And the contents of this moment, just be kind to it. Your breath, other people's breath. And other people's breath is certainly none yet. And my own breath is not my business either. I let the breath do it. And all I do, whatever's the most important object, the one which is right in front of me now, that's all I watch. Regarding meditation, I was told, not what you were told. You experiment, find out what is actually works for you. Because there's so many different teachings on meditation. So you're told by one monk, told by another nun, told by a lay teacher, told by whatever, and that really confuses you. Anyway, regarding meditation, I was told that mindfulness of the breath leads to one-pointedness, and if this is not practiced properly, wisdom shall not arise, as in the simile of a tortoise which stays for a long, long time inside its shell. Conversely, practicing mindfulness on the mind shall lead to wisdom. Can you please enlighten us on these two? They're both go, my young. Mindfulness of the breath does lead to one-pointedness. What is one-pointedness? The word one-pointedness is ekagata. Aga does not mean a point. It means a peak. And many people recognize that word, aga, from its Sanskrit equivalent of agra, the Mughal capital of India, Agra. It means to the peak, the capital, the summit, which is one of the reasons why it's not one point of this, it's one big, huge peak of the mind. And it's usually a simile, sorry, it's usually a word which is always associated with jhanas. It's one of the, sometimes called the factor of a jhana. It doesn't really appear elsewhere, to the point that the word ekagata, jhanas. So mindfulness of breath does lead to a jhanas. And if this is not practiced properly, wisdom should not arise. That is gomayang. Simply because samadhi paccaya yathabhuta jnana dasana, said the Buddha many times, from the stillness, and especially the samadhi, samma samadhi, is always, every time, talked of by the Buddha, explained by the Buddha as the jhanas. So that means that it is practiced properly in mindfulness of the breath, as in the Anapanasati Sutta, does actually lead to the jhanas. And the jhanas lead to seeing things as they truly are and wisdom. It is one of the reasons why, how did the Buddha become enlightened? He practiced jhanas under the Bodhi tree in the Majjhima 36. You know, when the Buddha was practicing all sorts of stuff, and then so frustrated, nothing was working, and then he had the memory of his experience of jhana as a young kid, under the rose apple tree while his father was doing the ceremony, the ploughing ceremony. And he remembered that experience, and then it says, perhaps that is the way to Sambodhi, enlightenment. And the insight occurred, yes, that is the way to enlightenment. Very powerful words from the sutta, from the source. And what happens is similar to a tortoise which stays for a long, long time inside its shell. I've never seen a tortoise stay forever in its shell. It will come out to get something to eat or to do something. The idea of a tortoise in a shell is more like a Hindu idea of the five limbs of a tortoise. The head, the two arms and the two feet. It's not really arms, but it's like 4 feet and a head. And it brings them inside. And that similarly is when you bring your five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching inside, and they just disappear. So the five senses gone, then you're left with the sixth sense of the mind. So actually it's only through the jhanas that you have direct experience of the citta, which is practicing mindfulness of the mind. If you look at what it says about the satipatthana of practicing mindfulness of the mind, it means you know when the mind is in jhana, you know when it's not in jhana, basically. So this is where. How do you know when it's not in jhana or is in jhana when you don't have experience of jhana? So it is true. You practice mindfulness of the breath. It leads to the jhanas. It's the 12th stage of anapanasati with mochayang chitang. With mochayang chitang, if you know your Pali, with mochayang is the almost like a past participle of vimokkha, which means it's the vimokkhas. The eight vimokkhas are always the jhanas and the arupa states, immaterial states. And so these are all references to the jhana. And so, mindfulness of the mind, the only way you can actually know the mind, what it actually is actually when the five senses disappear. There's a simile, which I haven't given yet on this retreat, but I use it very often, of the emperor. And the emperor, whenever the emperor appears in public, is always covered with five garments. It's got this huge helmet. It covers the head and overlaps the shoulders. Has a jacket which is overlaps, or the helmet overlaps the top of the jacket, with long sleeves and just goes way down the waist. Has gloves which cover, overlap the wrist of the jacket. And it has a lasting trousers. The top of the trousers overlap the bottom of the jacket. And big boots which overlap the bottom of the trousers. So there's no part of the skin of the emperor or anything of the body of the emperor can be seen. All you can see is the five garments of the helmet, the jacket, the gloves, the trousers, and the boots. And the question is, who is the emperor? Is it male or female? Is it even human? Is it old or young? Is it, whatever it is, it's really powerful. But the only time it appears in public is covered in these five garments. That simile is a simile of the mind covered with the five senses. And usually, actually, you can understand the only way you can understand truly what this mind is to take off the five garments and see real mind, pure mind. The Buddha's simile was the simile of the goldsmith who takes impure gold, which has got other trace elements in it. Like if anyone gets any gold in Australia, it's got sometimes some tin and iron and all these other elements It's not pure gold, and so you don't know its properties. But if you get a goldsmith, they refine that gold and take off all the five impurities. So there's just gold, 100% gold, pure gold, nothing else but gold. And then you can find out its properties. And that was a Buddha simile for the mind. Getting to know the pure mind. What is the mind? And then, when the five senses have disappeared, and all the impurities, the other trace elements, whatever you call them, I'm not a geologist, but once you take all that away, all you've got left is 100% pure gold. And then you can find out its properties. The only way you can be really mindful of the mind, of the citta, is to purify the citta of the other five senses. That is the purpose of jhanas, or one of its purposes. This morning you taught on impermanence regarding the cause and effect, like the simile of the flame. Can we say that the dead trees and live trees are also one of the examples of impermanence? It's dead trees and live trees. I'm not quite sure exactly what you're getting at. Examples of impermanence. It's they are part of the changing nature of life, but it must be much. You're just still in the world of the five senses. You see live trees and dead trees, but sometimes this is much deeper than that. Impermanence is far better described with something like even Schrodinger's cat, which defies, you know, how you think the world works, but it is true. Erwin Schrodinger, a German physicist, one of the founders of quantum theory, just, he had a thought experiment, something you would never do, because, you know, the RSPCA, Pater, and all sorts of other people would just, you know, the ethics committee of your university would never allow it. But they imagined putting his cat in a box, a sealed box, in which there was a cyanide capsule which could be broken only by a quantum process, the decay of a cesium atom, and it was a 50% chance after a certain time, you know, after about 3 or 4 minutes, say it was 4.2 minutes, a 50% chance that the cesium atom would decay and would crack the cyanide capsule and kill the cat. But no one could see that cat. No one could actually know if the cat was alive or dead. So the point was, the question which Erwin Schrodinger asked, and it was a powerful question which resonates to one's perception of reality even today. After that time, 4.2 minutes, the 50% chance that capsule has broken and the cat is dead. 50% chance it's alive. And you don't know. So the question was, is the cat alive or is the cat dead? And the truth of the matter is that the cat is not alive. The cat is not dead. It's neither. And this is not just being clever. This is truth. It's quantum probability. It's what we are now getting developed, the first quantum computers. This is real stuff. It's not just thought anymore. So what it does, it challenges our whole perception of reality. This is not sort of stuff which is meant to just confound logic. This is logic, but much more refined logic than most people are aware of. So the impermanence of trees, is the tree there or is it not? And it's alive or dead. They used to have this saying, this question, if a tree falls in a forest and no one sees it, has it fallen or is it still upright? And the answer was very clearly answered by Erwin Schrodinger.
It's neither. It's in between. It's a third state. So this is where sometimes even science sometimes confounds people. So impermanence. Do you really think you understand impermanence? If you really did, you would be on the path to enlightenment. You all want to be on the path. But what gets on the path? Are you or are you not? Or are you somewhere in between? And you say, where does, I can't understand this, Ajahn Brahm. Exactly. So what you do is, instead of allowing the mind, which hasn't enough data yet, to form conclusions, we gather more data. We go deeper into our stillness. And some of the data which you get, like little things, like I just mentioned the other day about watching a wall and watching it totally vanish. How did that happen? Other experiences when you start meditating, it's not craziness. It's actually more reasonable than the main world. When you, one of the first times, just seeing this black, jet black towel on the drying line near the washing place at Wat Nanachat in the early years. Clearly, just stunned, I never ever seen a towel which is as black as a piece of coal. And as I was watching it for about 3 or 4 minutes, wondering, what's happening? Then after about 3 or 4 minutes, it just changed. Back to white. It was always a white towel. But I was perceiving it as black. And your perception sometimes cannot be trusted. Just like it says in the suttas, sometimes you can see the light as dark. The night is day, the day is night. You're getting some interesting, powerful ways your mind works. But this is only when you train your mind in stillness. Stillness gives it power. It gives it data. It just overcomes the five hindrances. So the five hindrances only show you what doesn't challenge. You see what you want to see, you can't see what you don't want to see. And when those get suppressed, through deep stillness, things get thrown up to your mind which challenge you to the core. It's not just live and dead trees. Something much deeper than that. Thank you for getting Aye to do a guided meditation today. I had a great meditation after her short talk on taking a bus to no particular destination and just appreciating whatever sights appear. I saw experience many nimittas that came and went, but I was not able to get any further before they disappeared, despite doing my best to let go of the desire to do so. What am I to do not to do to go further? What you should do is invite her to give another guided meditation tomorrow to take it further. Be patient. Sometimes we always want to accelerate the path. When we accelerate, what happens? We lose control of the car, we get fined by the speeding cops, and we waste so much time. Just continue without trying to do anything else. You saw some limiters. Wonderful. What else do you want? Exactly. You want to go further. That is the problem. Would like to hear your advice on the following. The workplace that you're currently at is comfortable, but the salary is rather small. Your family is not in a tough situation where you have to earn more to support them. Is it a good idea to start looking for a high-paying job, but at the same time you're unsure if you're cut out for it? So if you're currently in is comfortable, the salary is rather small, I know what that feels like. My salary is extremely small. In fact, it's non-existent. I am exploited. You know what? Happily so. There was once, some years ago, when I was invited to a HR conference, human resource conference, in London. I was in Singapore, and this one afternoon they invited me to give a talk at a HR conference, just a talk there. And the people who listened to my talk, some of them were so impressed that they headhunted me. That's what HR people do. And they sent me this invitation to come to Docklands in London, to the Excel and New Convention Centre, to do a keynote talk at this biggest HR convention in Europe. And I thought it would be a good idea, because a free ticket to go to London and back, and at the same time visit family and friends. So I went there, and, you know, pretty jet-lagged, you know, just going there, and straight to a hotel, and just next to the Docklands, a cheap hotel. No, it wasn't a cheap hotel, but it was comfortable enough. And then in the morning, just rocking up for the keynote. And then, as I was just preparing, they were just, you know, prepping me up before we went into the hall, about 15 minutes, I got this call from the admission gates that there was a couple of people trying to get in for free who claimed to be my relations. And I said, I didn't know anyone coming sort of here to see me. You know, I got relations in UK, but they never told me they were going to turn up. So I checked out, I went down, and it was my brother and his daughter, my niece. And I recognized them. I said, oh yeah, and it's my brother and my niece. I said, well, you know, you're allowed to have one invited guest, you know, but not two. I said, I'll come all this way, you know, just come here. And I'm not taking any money from you, no honorariums or anything. I said, oh, okay, I understand. Okay, they can come in. So my brother and niece came in. My brother was a banker. My niece, she was actually organizing conference. You know, she finished university. She was getting a reasonable salary. So the first chance I had, I scolded them. Well, you're embarrassing me. You could afford a ticket. And anyway, if you can't afford a ticket, you know, you can, I'm going to go and visit you at home. You can listen to me as long as you like for free. And then they said, the reason why we refused to buy a ticket, because they were going to charge us £300 each to listen to Ajahn Brahm. £300 sterling for 1 hour talk. How much is that in Australian dollars? At that time, much more, maybe $500, $600. So how much do you pay to actually to come here and listen to how many hours of talks? And that was, I wasn't so well known then. So, you know, my market rate. Yeah, that's the joke. But anyway, so I am getting exploited, but I love it. So the workplace I'm coming at is comfortable. The salary is rather small. Your family's in a tough situation. Wonderful. You have to earn more to support them. Why do you have to support them? Let them see if they can live more frugally. More simply, why do you need a big house? Small houses are brilliant. They're environmentally friendly, no sort of climate, less climate problems. And the best thing about a small house or a little apartment is the whole family is cramped together, which means they learn how to love each other and get on together. Trouble with many, it's not just the size of a house creates problems because of the, you know, the amount of materials you have to buy to actually to build one, but also just the fact that everyone has their own room. So as a family, you don't learn how to sort of love each other. So I don't know how many people here, I often say this, I just had to share a bedroom with my brother just all my life until I left to become a monk. And so, you know, we got on together. Yeah, sometimes we fought, but there was no place to run away to. So those of you who, you know, remember when you came, some of you came to my 60th birthday and my brother came along as well, to see just how we get on together. So we love each other. Why? He's a banker, I'm a monk. Probably the opposite end of the scale. But this is one of the reasons why, because we grew up together in the same house. We could not run away. So big houses separate families. And if you grow up in a big house, your own room, your own escape, your own stuff, how on earth can you learn how to live with another person? And learn the skills of, you know, staying with your partner. So number one, you don't need to actually, tough situation, you have to learn more to support them. To support them to what standard? Sometimes our standard's way too high. What we expect in life. So you can always do less with more. And anyway, so if you are family in a tough situation, usually I'd say they're asking for too much. But I've got to send my kids to good schools. No, you don't have to send your kids to good schools. Have them in good family, good parents. The parents are the ones. Being with them will affect their education and their success in life much more than a school. My primary school, the local school, it was called Derwent Water Primary. Its nickname was Dirty Water. So when anyone asked, what school do you go to, Dirty Water? It was just this really old school. And it's only through scholarships that I got anywhere. Where did I get? Crazy, crazy intellectual universities where we thought that just the more you know, the wiser you were. And it was only just going to places like the local institution for mental health problems, going as a volunteer to help people with Down syndrome, was where I learned the wisest people, which I knew in Cambridge, were not at university. The ones who could feel, who could love, who could know when I was feeling upset or when I was feeling happy. They could sense that straight away. And that blew me away. All of the knowledge about the nature of quantum physics in the universe, it impresses people. Because you don't understand what I'm talking about, that's why it impresses. But to connect with people, to understand, you know, emotions, emotional intelligence, years before Daniel Goleman wrote that book, you know, you started to learn there's much more there. So send them to a good school. Life, kindness, a good family. You don't have to be rich. Just one of the things I jump on, everybody says that, you know, they are proud that they are poor. It's almost like an accolade. You rose from just poverty. But my family were poor. And I remember, just to prove it, this one occasion when my father, coming home from work, you know, put a £1 note. It's on the mantel shelf. They had an open fire, usually coal, which is where the London smog came from in those days. A coal fire, and just to keep the place livable, warm, it was freezing. And then, somehow or other, they put a pound note on the mantel shelf, and a breeze came from nowhere, just a waft of air, and the pound note lifted up and fell into the fire, you know, into the flames. And my father reached in to try and take it out. He burnt himself. He couldn't save the £1 note. And my mother burst into tears. wet. £1 was really a lot of money for them. And now it was gone. I was really willing to, you know, get a pretty serious burn. My mother's weeping. £1 was so valuable. Just gone like that. So that's one of the reasons why. But I wouldn't have changed that family for the world. I learned so much from them. They did have emotional intelligence. Brilliant stuff. Like, right. We're going to personal stuff, but I think it's valid to start talking like this. My grandfather, paternal grandfather from Liverpool, was a child abuser of violence, not really sort of sexual. At least I never heard anything like that, but he was plumber in Liverpool in the Depression years, very little work. And so he, whatever money he had, he'd get drunk every evening, come back, take off his belt, and just whip any kid for any reason at all in front of him. And my father always said that, you know, as painful as that was, it was never as hurtful as when afterwards he'd, you know, start whipping his mother, you know, my paternal grandfather's wife, my paternal grandmother. And my dad could not protect her, could not protect his mum from the violence. And he said that just hurt so deeply. But he said, he told me that he somehow made a determination, a resolution, a promise, that if he survived, if he lived through that, and that if he ever had children, he would never beat them. He never used physical violence against his kids. And he never did. Even though I say my brother and I deserved it several times. I'm saying that because everyone else would get beaten, you know, spanked or something, but he could never do it to us. He just couldn't. Because he would remember the abuse from his father. And that taught me a lot. Just because you've been hurt and abused, you don't need to give revenge onto others. And sometimes we give revenge, you know, we think that's the way we beat others. That's what my father did to me. But no, it would stop the cycle of violence, of abuse, stopped. And he stopped it in himself. So, parents weren't rich, but my goodness, they were wise. Anyway, Ajahn, do you think that the kind and gentle approach to meditation is particularly effective if one has already developed strength of mind and mental discipline through a monk strict approach? Thank you, not really. I've seen many people, they just don't even develop the mental discipline. Where does that mental discipline come from anyway? Sometimes if it's a habit, you've succeeded and survived through strong effort and mental discipline. And sometimes you just can't let it go. You get attached to success through hard work. And hard work can actually get you past exams. It can just get you beating your enemies. It can just get you to win the race. But why? There's no wisdom in sheer effort. So which is one of the reasons why the kind and gentle approach to meditation is that for everybody. That's how I understand the Buddha taught. It is another way. And one reason why that everybody can develop those jhanas and get enlightened. If you had to be tough and strong and disciplined, and how many of you would succeed? It would mean it's only for the elite, the tough ones, the Olympic gold medalist meditators, which means that you wouldn't have a chance. And the nice thing is, the good news is, you don't have to do that. Those are the ones who just usually fade away. It's wisdom power, not willpower. It's through wisdom that you reach the goal. As I say, self-discipline. What are you disciplining? Who's doing the discipline? What are you trying to do? So not the army. So this is actually where you find that there's this other path, a great path. The Buddha tried discipline and effort. The 6 years, we tried all sorts of stuff which would kill me. And afterwards, he found out with extreme effort, you know, holding his breath, not eating, standing on one leg, and just fasting. It takes enormous discipline to fast. How hard is it just to not have anything to eat afternoon until the following morning? And that's pretty tough. Imagine not eating anything for days, or just one grain of rice, or whatever it was. And trying the extremes of discipline and effort. And it didn't work. And that was the time he said, is there any other way? And that's when we remembered the jhanas. And it's not through such an emaciated, weak body that you can easily get these jhanas. So that's why, after having that insight, maybe the jhanas are the way to enlightenment, he ate. He rested. He washed. And his first 5 disciples abandoned him, thinking he's given up the path. And now, how can you get enlightened just living this easy life like washing and eating properly? And so they abandoned him. So alone, he followed that insider intuition. And healthy, under a shade of a good tree, sat down and entered jhanas, and thereby became our Buddha. Not through hard effort. And the first teaching he gave, don't do that. It's called Atta-Giramatthanu Yoga. It is. Anu Yoga literally means just two animals, two balls tied together. You tying yourself to Atta-Giramatha. It is practices which tire you, exhaust you, take away your energy, which harm you. And you know that what those are. Discipline. Just getting the Zen stick out. Just force. Shaming people. Shaming yourself. So this is not the way. It's kind and gentle. And tomorrow morning, get into the second factor of the Eightfold Path. We see the kindness and gentleness is right there, clearly stated by the Buddha, after right view, the right motivation. That's coming. Dear Ajahn, are the Garuda and other mythological beasts exist only in people's mind, or do they have their own existence? Okay, I've seen 2 Garudas. And this is not a joke. I'm not in the joking mood this evening, as you see. This was in northeast Thailand. Can I actually say this? I think it's okay. Northeast Thailand, on the Burmese border, on the Thailand side of it, in this high in the mountains, in this wonderful monastery. Lots of nice experiences from there. And it's a great monastery. And I was the only one there. This is my 6th range retreat. When I was allowed to leave the monastery and just go and find some solitude, visiting all these great teachers who were still alive at the time, and finding a nice place for the range retreat up in the mountains. And it was paradise for me. It was literally in the middle of a tea plantation. Imagine the ecstasy for a British monk. As much tea as I ever wanted. And not only that, it was the lay community there. They weren't interested in listening to any Dhamma. They just wanted to feed me. And, you know, sometimes if you're a monk, you know, well, this is paradise. No one bothered with questions or chanting or anything. They just feed me. Very good. And then off I go to the rest of the day by myself. And then, Then also there's caves there, really deep caves, you know, just like that. There's that same area as the wild boar football team. That sort of same area up there. And no one was there. And I asked the villagers, "Why? This is a perfect place. So why aren't there any monks here?" So, and they said, "Because it's too quiet for them." That's an interesting comment, because they wanted something to do, but this was brilliant for myself. So I was there, because you're over in sort of jungle area, you saw some weird stuff. And one day, I was meditating, coming out of a meditation, and there was something really strange. You actually feel, you know, electricity in the air. There's no electricity in the air, but you feel there's something happening. You get very sensitive to your environment. And I went outside my hut. I was in my hut, not in the cave. And the sky was full of birds. You know, you see like flocks of birds like migrating. This was the whole sky, you know, from horizon to horizon in all directions. The whole thing was covered with birds of all different species. Now, every bird which flew was up there in the sky. And there were these two enormous birds. I've seen eagles before. These weren't eagles. I remember in Norway once going up into the mountains and seeing a king's eagle. It was perched. I just came over a ridge. It was perched. And it was as literally big as me, just perched, without its wingspan. And it just looked straight at me. You know, it was maybe about 10 meters away. And then I just turned around and very calmly just walked away. That could have, you know, killed you easily. Huge, a king's eagle up in the mountains of Norway. But this time it was something bigger and weirder, and there was two of them. And they were just like going through the sky. And just, I was just in awe. And all these other birds, it was almost like king and queen of the birds, you know, just flying through on a royal sort of whatever it was. And every bird was up there. Never seen anything like it since or before. So often I wonder what that was. Never seen any bird like that in any book. Maybe that's the origin of Garudas. But you can't believe me, you didn't see it. But, you know, I stand by that. I have tightness on my neck, shoulder and hips, even before meditation. When doing meditation, should I focus or relax on the area? This is your back. Should I focus or relax on that area, but still pay and then continue on breathing? If you have tightness on your neck, shoulder and hips, even before meditation, I would actually start by doing some relaxation of those areas. Even just going out doing some exercise, so actually to loosen that sort of tightness. And after a while, if by just loosening it by some movement, some exercise, then when you close your eyes, you know what I would do, I'd focus on that area and just relax to the max. I imagine those areas, the muscles are being pulled apart, that stress. And so I imagine just letting go of both ends. And if you ever actually stretch an elastic band, and then you just loosen it, and loosen it. And so it gets, there's no tension there. When I visualize it, you know, it's easy for the body actually to follow. Instead of just saying, just relax, I just imagine as if those muscles have been pulled by these invisible demons and pulled apart and say, let go, guys, let go, let go. And I can feel it, imagine it relaxing. And I can feel the real relaxation happening, which means that it does relax. And then after a while, as it relaxes to the best you can, then just let your mind decide. If the mind wants to go to the breath, I'll mention this later on when we go to breath meditation. You don't choose. I never choose. I'm going to watch the breath. I just become still and the breath is there. It never forces things. Because when you force, okay, I'm going to be aware of the breath now. it's never sort of peaceful. It's never natural. But when I just relax, and the meditation I teach you is what I do, then after a while, just the breath. And when I just let the breath come to me, it's gorgeous, it's delightful. That's why, hey breath, it's like, you know, we hang out together, but I never control it. When it's ready, it will come. It usually comes pretty quickly. Okay. Dear Ajahn, please ask meditators not to bring a cell phone into the meditation hall. Okay. Meditators, please don't bring a cell phone into the meditation hall. You can ask, but sometimes people make mistakes, and sometimes the cell phone is actually used for recording the talks. So if you do bring a cell phone into the meditation hall, please put it on not airplane mode, on jhana mode. So you only use it to record, and check that out. But people do make mistakes. So it's not the phone disturbs you. You disturb the phone. You know why it's called a cell phone? Yeah. Because it's got bars on it. Have a look. Check how many bars. Shows you how many good your reception is. Why is your body a prison? Your body is a prison because it's made up of cells. Okay. Does Jataka Sutta come from the Buddha himself? Some of Jataka stories about animals to be a bodhisattva who have wisdom. Please comment. Thank you. The idea of a bodhisattva was only from the time of the Buddha, or rather Gautama, descending from the Tusita realm until the time under the Bodhi tree when he became fully enlightened. That's the only time in the sutta where they call this being a bodhisattva. The idea of a bodhisattva doing all of these practices to become our Buddha is Gomaya. And I say that because one of the Jataka tales, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya, is the Gatikara Sutta. It's a very, as soon as you see that, whoa, that is sutta, primary source, and you see there the Buddha, or Kassapa. And the Buddha Kassapa had a very senior close disciple called Gatikara, who was a once returner, an anagami, but could not ordain as a bhikkhu because he had two parents who were blind. And this is a wonderful description of what it means to be a non-returner. A description, a portrait of the life of a non-returner. The only reason why they wouldn't go forth, because they had to look after their blind parents. And Gatikara means like a potter, one who makes pots, okay. And he would not even involve himself with money. He would put the pots on a bench outside his workshop and say, anyone who wants a pot, please take one for free. And if you want to leave a donation, just like some rice or some beans or vegetables or whatever, just leave them, whatever you want. No money, no amounts. It's just this beautiful, whatever you want, take. But, you know, I'm looking after my parents, please give something in return. And most people would do that. And he had a friend, Jyotipana. Was it Jyotipana? I always get those two. I say it was Jyotipana, wasn't it?
Jyotipana,
yeah. Jyotipana was his friend. And Jyotipana...
Pana.
It was Pala.
Pala, Jyotipana.
Yeah, I thought it was Pala. Anyway, doesn't matter. Jyoti. If
for sure, yeah. So, okay, I can't just, because this was an important person, Jyotipala. So Jyotipala was Gatikara's friend, and Jyotipala would always refuse to go and see the Buddha Kassapa. And Gatikara said, come and see this monk, he's amazing, he's a Buddha. Yeah, I don't believe in that sort of stuff. Just sort of a shaven-headed, good-for-nothing. That's what Jyotipala said about this monk Kassapa. And what happened once was Gatikara took hold of Jyotipala's hair and pulled it to drag him. He said, you really go too far. You know, you're risking our friendship because you think it's so important to see your monk. Okay, I'll go. I mean, how many of you, you know, even just a little monk like me, you know, say, oh, you should go and see Ajahn Brahma, you should go and see this monk, or go and see Ajahn Chah, go and see Lumpur Ganha. Ah, no, they're just fools who don't believe in that sort of stuff in religion. But anyway, that was like Jyotipala. But as soon as Jyotipala came in the presence of the Buddha Kassapa, it was a whole different sort of ball game. Jyotipala got faith and ordained. And the story then just diverts in the Gatikara Sutta about what happened to Gatikara. And the Buddha told that story in the Gatikara Sutta and said, I was Jyotipala in a former life. That's a real Jataka tale, where the Buddha, our Buddha, in a previous life, couldn't even recognize for a long time the presence of another Buddha, the previous one, and even said bad things about Gatikara. Kassapa. And at the Buddha's, after the Buddha's enlightenment, Gatikara, who had obviously passed away, now an anagami in the Sudawasa, came to see his friend, Buddha Gotama. So we were in the same village together in a previous life. And I came to see an old friend who is now the Buddha. Congratulations. Two old friends meeting. That is more realistic. That's the Jataka. And as far as I'm concerned, there's a lot of evidence that if you were... Because Jyotipala became a monk under Buddha Kassapa. And if someone became a monk under Buddha Kassapa, surely they'd at least become a stream winner. Some with that degree of spiritual power. Maybe that Jyotipala became a once-returner, because once-returners, for the most part, it's said in the suttas, are reborn in the Tusita realm. And we know the story of Siddhartha Gautama from the time he descended from the Tusita realm, the Bodhisatta, the Buddha-to-be, being born in Lumbini. And this is my last life. How would the Bodhisatta know that unless this was his last life? He was a once returner. And this was his last life. Have a look at Gatikara Sutta. And in the Devakuta Samyutta, Gatikara coming to say, well done to the Buddha. Okay, please excuse me. Sometimes I'm not going to go past 9:30 today, so if it's yeah.
So how come the tales of the Jakarta tales are widely taught in many countries, especially in Thailand, especially the ten the ten cha tales
yes.
about the Buddha.
The reason why that those things occurred
was in the competition. This is my theory, but it's got good grounds. It's not just my theory, it's many of the monks' understandings, is that those 10 Jatakas are about the previous Buddha, about our Buddha, I call him our Buddha, Buddha Gautama, developing the 10 paramita. And there was never any mention about paramita in the original Buddhist suttas. But then we came, the Mahayana started to develop about 400 or 500 years, some say even later, but no, a few hundred years after the time of the Buddha. And there they said there was another path, not just being an arahat, but being a bodhisattva. Put off your enlightenment for the sake of helping other beings. And to do that, the Mahayana developed 6 paramita. Not to be outdone. Theravada got 10 paramita. It was terrible keeping up with the Joneses stuff. So they had 10. So 10, if the Buddha Gautama had 10 paramitas, where did he get them from? And so you have this, if you actually start teaching, for example, the 10th Vaisantura Jataka, you know, two Westerners, translate it, child abuse, just not sort of looking after your wife, is sending your kids, you know, to a violent person, giving your wife away. I mean, all of that stuff, that people lose faith in Buddhism. Straight away, if they worship that, is that how you develop being a Buddhist, being a Buddha, giving things away without any responsibility or duty to your wife and kids? So sometimes look at that, it's disgusting, basically. It's nice to know it's not real Buddhism. But I have to be careful. Actually, I don't have to be too careful these days, because I've got clout. I'm senior monk, good reputation, so I can say such things without getting into too much trouble. If you say that as a layperson, or say that as a young monk, or especially if you say that as a nun, you get in big trouble. So who are you to say that? Well, you know, I've just got some power because of all of you. So they can say this, and it's pretty obvious stuff. So that's where those 10 Jataka tales came from. Anyway, yeah, Ajahn, I have a broken heart. Excellent. So now you know what it feels like, you know, when you invest your happiness in a person who cannot ever make you happy. When you ask from this world something it can't give you, and you get disillusioned. From that suffering, that's where wisdom can arise. There's a beautiful, many of you have seen this before, it's sometimes they call it transcendental dependent origination. Now from dukkha, you experience suffering, and all of your fantasies about the world sort of get shattered. You did the right thing. You were not at fault. And just, you know, you give so much to who you think is the love of your life, or just the person which you like so much, and it just all falls apart for no reason. You think, this is terrible. From that suffering, you have a choice. And many people, they come into Buddhism because of suffering. And you see pictures like of Ajahn Chah. Joy at last, to know there's no happiness in the world. What the heck does that mean? It means there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with your partner. There's nothing wrong with your body. Welcome to life. Dukkha. Being separated from what you want. And you can't just control it. You can't get someone like people do. Ajahn Brahm, you know, we give you a donation, but can you bribe? Please bribe. Can you chant? Really chant hard. So that you know, person loves me, or so that you know, they can. can't do that. And if I could, I wouldn't. Why? Because I'm taking away. You're so uncompassionate, Ajahn Brahm. Okay, maybe I can fix your broken heart, but it's going to break again. So I'm just kicking the can down the road, as they say. Instead, broken hearts, my cup is broken. This is Ajahn Chah's great simile. See this cup? It's broken. And he would do this to me, and I said, I can't send you crack, Ajahn Chah. And I thought my master was cracks, not my cup. there's no crack in here. He said, it's microscopic. So you can't see it, but it's here. Because one day someone will drop this, or they'll kick it, it will fall over, and that crack, which is already there, a microscopic fracture in the ceramic, will open up and it will break. If this was a plastic, there would be no crack there, so you wouldn't have to care for it. Because it's fragile, because it's got a crack in it, you know that when it does crack, I expected that. You don't expect your heart not to break. Or your heart's already cracked. One day that fissure will open up. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. We don't want to hear that. We want to hear happy ever after. You know, somewhere, she's out there somewhere. Your soulmate. The love of your life. It's just, we haven't met yet. I know she's out there somewhere. The fantasy. But, when you know this, okay, this is tough teachings, but I'm in that sort of mood today. So, when I know this will crack, I care for it. Make sure I don't waste my time caring for friends, disciples, family, whatever. And when it does crack, I don't mourn or weep. There is no grief. Because I expected it. But, I think Ajahn Bhamani will not mind me saying this, but when his father died suddenly, he had prostate cancer. But then he didn't die. Well, maybe it was partially caused because maybe he'd been weak. He just fell down the stairs and hit his head and died. But he said to me, he said, you know, I didn't feel sad or grief. You know, in fact, he said, you know, maybe it's a harsh thing to say about a father you love. But I thought, what a relief that was. He died quickly. His death was going to happen with prostate cancer. But instead of that cancer dragging on for months and years, it actually finished quickly. So there was no grief there. There was a sense of, well done. Some suffering was ended. Inevitable. Just happened much quicker. With less pain. So anyway, I meditate, I start with the metta chanting, but it doesn't help. What can I do? It's when you have a broken heart, don't heal it. Keep it broken. It's not yours. None of my business. Happiness alas, to know I cannot invest my energy and my happiness in having other people I love with me all the time. They're going to go. And if you allow your heart to be broken, you let it happen. You don't try and mend it. You're with the pain. Embrace the pain. Then the pain just takes on a different flavor. A flavor of wisdom. Or a path. Yeah, it hurts. But it's a way forward. It's growing pain where you learn. You learn that hearts break, that attachments are going to lead to suffering and pain. So it means we just have to be cold and have no one we care for and love. It's weird, you know, but in a very profound sense, I love each one of you. I care for you. I'm very happy to see you. Hi, Ananda, how are you doing? It's like friendship, kindness, but no, really deep. Kalyana Mitta, good friends. But then, if suddenly you go, if Ananda comes up to me and says, you know, I heard the sweet voice of Jesus, I'm converting to being a Christian. That's been wonderful having, you know, known you. Please, you know, have a wonderful life as a Christian, or whatever. You know, he won't sort of say, what? All that time and effort I've given to you, So the greatest act of love is to let someone go. It's beautiful. I love that saying. You let someone go, the greatest act of love. Go with my blessing. Wonderful to have known you and seen you. We had a wonderful time together. Go. You free people, and you free your own heart as well. And the time we've had together is a wonderful, blessed time, which means it enriches you. And all the people you live with and meet, even that people who come out of your own womb, people you're so close to, you let them go. Thank you for being with me for such a long time. There's no broken hearts, it's sweet and sour. Anyway, wisdom. Ajahn, please tag the nun. I don't know her name. It's Mu Nis Ura. So, have you got a nickname yet? Is it Mu?
Yeah.
Mu, there you go, Mu. So, for this afternoon's guided meditation, it was very insightful. We didn't get a chance to say sadhu, 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 he. So, okay, now you have your chance. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yeah, okay. Today, guided meditation was so good. Can we have more guided meditations, maybe from the other three nuns? Sorry? You asked a question? What do you reckon? Who's next in line? You? You're next in line? Well, it's not me, it's the lay people, you know, they're the ones who feed you. You can discuss that amongst yourself. We'll use what happens. If you say, okay, tomorrow evening, then tomorrow at 3 p.m. Okay, so it's 4 nights, so you can have from 2 to 3, and 3 to 4. I think it's usually the job of the senior nun, so if I am moved, gave a very good one, you can give another one tomorrow. But if, you know, you get a bit sick or sub-sick, then you can, whoever's next in line.
Only if they feel like it.
Only if they feel like it. Okay, there's ways of making them feel like it. Now that, Venerable Nisra. Any little tricks for getting that passenger none of my business feeling as much as possible? It's just think about it, just being a passenger. You don't have to pay a fare on this monastery, in this retreat. You know, things have already been done. You're never going to get kicked out of this place. I know that many of you deserve to be kicked out sometimes, but you know that I never do such things. You're always allowed here, dear, with kindness. And none of your business. What is your business here? What do you need? If out of this bottle, I don't know, maybe, let's do it, let's rub it. Is a genie coming up? No. This is not a genie bottle. So if a genie did come out and he had 3 wishes, what would those wishes be? If I could give you 3 wishes, using all of my powers and grant them to you, what would they be? Would you want your broken heart healed? Would you like to win the lottery? Not just the West Australian lottery. What's the biggest lottery in the world? US lottery or something?
Yeah.
Sorry, is it?
American, about 700 million.
700 million. Would you like, is that US or ringgit?
US.
Sorry?
US.
700 million, would you like that? What else would you like? Good health? If you asked me that, then you would deserve to be kicked out of this place. You're asking for what's stopping you penetrating the Dhamma. The sickness is there to teach you. You're not in control of your body. It's not yours. Even if you eat healthy food and you exercise, you still die and get sick. It's part of life. If you want lots and lots of money, welcome to it. There'll be, wherever there's honey, there's bees come around to try and... Is it bees? No, the bees actually make the honey. Whatever. Anyway, there's always flies come to get their share. And if there's good health, good, lots of money, what else did I say? Whatever you want. Oh, just a partner. A partner who will never complain. Who will always be there for you. Who will always give you emotional support. Who, when they need to be quiet, you can actually tell them to be quiet. And they follow orders. And they've always got a good sense of humour and always entertaining. And they say that's called a TV set. You can always switch them off. You can always, they can always entertain you when you need to, and you can always switch them off when they're always there for you. Or a dog or a cat or something. But those things, they don't exist. So be careful. What would you want if I saw a genie? They said, Ajahn Brahm, you did so much good work. What can I give you? I say, nothing. Off you go. Whoa. Okay, not even genies yet. Come on, good. Okay, maybe not finished. But this was that story. You know, as monk, not allowed to have any money. Real monks, you know, not, and good nuns as well, don't have any money. But there's a loophole. In every legal system, there are always loopholes. And being an expert in the Vinaya, I know my loopholes. So, what can happen? Ananda says, Ajahn Brahm, you really helped out. Can I get you anything? And it's not just for monasteries or nunneries or Albany project or this joint, for you. You know, I'll give enough to these other places. What do you need for you? And sometimes when they ask me, this layperson asked me this once in Thailand years ago. And he said, well, you know, just usually have to say just exactly just what sort of money you're talking about. You know, 100,000 or just dollar. So they usually say, here's $20. What can I get you? Something personal. It's $100 in my fund. And I had to ask that. So this time, this fellow in Thailand said, I've got 100 baht, I want to give it to you, you know, for whatever use you have. And my mind went blank. You know, when you don't go shopping and you don't think about what you want, you know, you just, I don't know. And he said, well, come on, I've got to go to work. And I thought, can you come back tomorrow and I'll get a list for you? He said, yeah, good idea. So that night, I went to my hut, and this is what happened. That had a candle, you know, which I lit just about with these matches. Ajahn Liam, great monk, but he would give us one box of matches to last the whole 3 month range retreat. Talk about frugality. And we couldn't find any other matches, and it was wet. So, you know, there were these cheap matches which were really soaking. You had to find something to make sure they were kept dry. And you wouldn't be able to get any other matches. So you had to be really careful. So the first thing I said, like cigarette lighter. You know, that's much more reliable than matches in the rainy season in Thailand, in the monsoons. So I wrote that down. I didn't have actually any paper. It was a mosquito coil wrapper, which was on one side had the brand name, on the other side it was like white paper, so I wrote it down. He said, lighter, and then like an exercise book, you know, a simple thing, so I can write things on. And I was writing the pencil. And he said, no, just a simple, you know, like biro pen, you know, which everybody has. No, not a Mont Blanc or a Parker, just an ordinary little pen. And then I said, but I know it's bad for your eyes. So I was just writing it down with a candle. So I thought, how about one of those little oil lamps? And talking about oil lamps and light, I really needed a flashlight for actually to go backwards and forwards from my hut to the hall for in the evening times, for the evening meeting, and just to get there in the early morning at 3 o'clock when it was still dark. There were snakes out there. I needed a proper flashlight. And actually, just talking about snakes, I needed some sandals. I'm going barefoot everywhere. And I had this list down, and then I knew roughly how much they cost, and 100 baht wasn't enough. And once I'd written them down, every one of those things was absolutely vital and essential. I don't know how I could survive without them before. And as I was trying to think what I can take off the list, I thought, oh, well, you know, I should be writing to my mother. I need some aerograms. And I kept on adding things more and more and more and more until I realized what was going on. And I just screwed up the piece of paper, threw it in the bin, and in the morning, I told that man, don't you ever do that to me again. I was so happy before when I didn't have any means to get anything. And now you give me all this means, 100 baht, and it wasn't enough. Not having anything, that was enough. But having the means to get something would be never enough. Have you got enough? Enough money? Have you enough money? Well, maybe you can tell the bank not to give you any more interest. Tell your pension scheme, your superannuation, please, we don't need any more. You can actually give that all away. Have you got enough? How many of you are still working hard to get enough? How much is enough? So there you were in Thailand, you know, just really poor, but so happy. Didn't need anything. That's the trouble with wanting. Wanting is never enough. If life is a process of the five components constantly changing and rebirth is a continuation of that process with a new set of components, how is it that karma and memories transfer from one life to the next where nothing else does? Ah, this is why it is that a mango, you eat the mango, you plant the seed in the ground, you know the simile which I constructed, and the seed, you can take a photo of every transition point, you know, so many photos, still photos from one to the other. What goes across from the first mango to the new mango? Nothing, except some of the characteristics. Even the DNA changes, mutates. But if the old mango was drought resistant, the new one would have some of those qualities. Not exactly the same, but not different either. If you plant a mango, you never get an avocado from the new tree. What goes across from one to the other? What goes across from one life to another? It's just a process. Not the same, but not different. Where is your memory stored now? Do you remember when you were a kid? How do you know? Where is that stored? So, how do memories go from your youth to your middle age to your old age? Where are they stored? Da-da-da. Okay. Wow, someone's been typing out. The first cause of our existence is not known, but dependent origination helps explain the continuation of this existence, thus a cause of cycle and birth and death. Only at parinibbana the process finally ceased. Presumably the positive mind energy cancelled with the negative mind energy at parinibbana. We came from nothing and therefore we go back to nothing. I don't know how many of you have seen The Life of Brian. We come from nothing and we go back to nothing. You've got to say this with the English accent. Nothing, with two F's instead of TH. However, is it possible that after enlightenment, parinibbana, from nothing, we might come back to become something again? Oh, no. Just like the first course started. Could there be a cycle of existence and ceasing of existence which keep repeating itself like birth and death? In other words, after you're enlightened, you're not really finished? Of course not. But how do you know? And this is where that first monkonaut, Rohitasa, going into space, trying, this is a levitator, so, really, Guinness Book of Records levitator, just went into outer space and died on the journey, because he was trying to find out where the world ends, the universe ends, not just planet Earth, but the universe. He managed to get to places where the moon and the sun shine not. That's pretty far out. But he died on the journey. Surprise, surprise. And when he came back, he asked these beings, heavenly beings, I tried to find the end of the universe, I couldn't. And they kept on sending him up to different levels of existence. This is that, what God didn't know, Sutta, in the Digha. Oh, it's a Digha, it's Majjhima. Well, wherever, somewhere. And anyway, that in the end, he asked the Mahabrahma, where does the world cease without remainder? And should I say this? I could take it off the talks because sometimes it can be offensive to some religions. The Mahabrahma said, I am the great Brahma, the great God, the creator, the beginner, the all-powerful, the all-knowing, blah, blah, blah. He said, yeah, I know that, but you're not answering my question. Where does the world cease without remainder? I am the Brahma, blah, blah, blah. Yes, well, answer my question. And so God took this monk by the side. So no one else could hear the conversation. He said, look, I don't know. But I'm supposed to be God, so I don't want other people, to find out that I don't know something. I'm supposed to be the omniscient. But anyway, you monk are stupid. Your teacher, the Buddha, go and ask him. He's much wiser than me. So, he went to go and see the Buddha, and the Buddha said, wonderful teaching, the beginning and the end of the world, the beginning and the end of the world, is to be found in your own body and mind. Not out there, but in here. Looking out there for truth, for meaning, for reason. We forget to look in this direction. In this body and mind, you'll find the beginning and the end, the cause and the termination of the universe. That's really neat stuff. And this one, Hi Jan Brahma, till now I don't know how to relax. Should I repeat saying relax, relax, relax on myself? That's not enough. Relax to the max. You get into it, okay, all together, relax to the max. It's not a joke, because when you do that, you remember that, and sometimes when you get stressed out, you say that enough times, and what you say, what you actually focus on, the body responds. It's a good thing to do. How does one something without attachment? Oh, live without attachment. I find this hard to do, especially with my family and my dogs. love is different than attachment. Attachment is when even your ego and your sense of happiness is tied to those family and dogs. But if you really love somebody, it may be your daughter or your son, and they're getting married to someone. And you say, oh no, they're not good enough for you, my son, because, you know, I love you too much. So that story of that son, he brought home all these people to his parents, and his mum said, no, she's not good enough. And at last, he brought back this girl, his mother liked her. She said, just the same as your mother. But then the father didn't give permission for him to marry. Too much like my wife. Oh, this. Okay, just ending up with some silly stories. Oh, about the mother that after her daughter finished university and graduated with honours and in, I think it was medicine or something. And, no, it was actually an anthropology. And she wanted to spend a year sort of doing service for the poor people of the world. So with her mother's blessing, she went on the gap year, you know, after university, before getting a job. And when she came back, she'd actually volunteered in some of the poor places in Africa. And when her mother was waiting for her to come off the plane, the aircraft, she came through immigration with this guy. He, you know, with all the beads and the grass skirt and all the markings and just the little rattle, you know, he's an indigenous medicine man from South Africa somewhere. And the mother said, darling. And said, who's that? He said, that's my husband, said the daughter. Look, I told you to go and marry a rich doctor. Oh, I thought you said. I know that's quite offensive to some people. Okay. Thank you for laughing this time of night. So live without attachment. You can have a wonderful life without attachment. You let people go. You give and give and give when it's time for them to go. You've done your very maximum. And then you let them go. Your kids. I don't know where your kids are going to go. How they're going to end up. Where they're going to end up. That's one of my father's sayings. Son, the door of my heart will always be open to you, no matter what you ever do. If you do things which embarrasses him, if I become notorious, you're my son. It's enough. That's love without attachment. I feel happier when helping in kitchen than practicing meditation. Oh, great. Are you a male or female? Because we can get you a job in the monk's monastery, doing the kitchen, or in the nun's monastery. Do you need some more people helping in the kitchen in Dhammasara? Yeah, we can find a job for you. And helping in the kitchen and practicing meditation, what should I do? Very good, carry on. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you forever, grateful for your guidance and teaching. Sadhu, sadhu. All these teachings, they thank me forever? Don't you know Anicca? There is no forever. So thank you for the time being. That's more wise. Okay. How to differentiate trying to relax or laziness? If anything, we're just so averse to laziness that if you want to actually to make any errors, just go to the side of laziness. People are too guilty in the Western world to be lazy. If you're lazy, can you really be lazy without guilt? A lot of people can't. which means they always go far away from the mean, the middle way, into just too much stress. It's very hard to see someone who's lazy in this world. Have you ever seen a real lazy person? If you're going to be lazy, I mean, do it properly. See, I don't even bother to think. Just sit here. Computers? That's too much hard work. Just be too lazy even to press a button and turn on your iPhone. Be really lazy. And just sit here doing nothing. Not even thinking. Just watching. Wow. Laziness is cool. Real laziness, not fake laziness. If you know what fake laziness is, it means just doing what you want, still doing something, and just not really doing any duties. It's just still doing things, fantasizing, dreaming. But real laziness is sitting here, not even thinking. That is cool. I've got to do two questions. Thanks for getting. The red carpet causes lots of noise. Should I be focused on my feet or also on the noise? There are people who can walk without making any noise at all. Those are called burglars. They can walk on that carpet without making any noise. So see if you can lift your feet and put them down. No one knows you've come. No one knows you're gone. The silence, like a cat walking on the roof. They can do that. So if nothing else, if you don't get enlightened or jhanas on the walking meditation path, At least you can qualify for a job with the CIA or ACO or any other secret service, because now you know how to walk without making any sound. Lastly, can you please give advice for eating meditation? Do I focus on my mind or body? How to stop myself from overeating when I know I won't eat again until tomorrow? This is the wrong question for this time of night. So we'll leave that question until it's appropriate, which is tomorrow sometime. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. Have a wonderful night, if you wish to.